Major Vladimir Karamazov glanced to Captain Natalia Temarovna at his side in the gathering darkness. He could just make out the outline of her profile, the skin of her face smudged with black camouflage stick, a black silk bandana tied over her hair, her hands fitted with tight black leather fingerless gloves, a close-fitting black jumpsuit covering the rest of her lithe body. He noticed her hands again. She held an assault rifle the way most women held a baby. A smile crossed his thin lips, his black camouflage-painted cheeks creasing at the corners of his mouth into heavy lines. Karamazov upped the safety catch on the blued black Smith & Wesson Model 59 in his right hand. Like all the people in his special KGB liquidation squad, he carried strictly American or Western European-made firearms. In the event that they encountered a substantial American force, regular or irregular, there was nothing to identify himself or any of his hand-picked, personally trained team as Soviet. Their English was perfect Midwestern. All of them trained, as was Karamazov himself, at the KGB's top-secret Chicago espionage school. They had read American books and newspapers, watched videotapes of American television, worn American-made clothes, trained on American-made firearms, American food, American slang, everything so American that they soon thought, talked, and acted like Americans who had lived in the country all their lives. At times, it seemed as though the only exception to them actually being Americans was their often tested allegiance to the KGB. Like most of the top clandestine operatives in the KGB, Karamazov, like the girl beside him in the darkness, had gone to the Chicago school in his mid-teens. He had grown up playing basketball and betting on the World Series. For years, Karamazov's one outside interest, besides chess, had been American football. He had arranged to attend three Super Bowls and had sat in the crowd happily munching hot dogs, drinking beer, and shouting. He had cheered no less earnestly than everyone around him. He had been Arnold Warshawski of South Bend, Indiana, or Craig Bates of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or some other alias. Karamazov was also a past master at dyeing his hair, creating life mask wrinkles or built-up noses. Sometimes he would stroke his cheek expecting to find a full beard and remember suddenly that that had been yesterday. Instead of 43, with a red beard and broken nose, he was 28 and blonde, with a small mustache and a nose that looked as though it had been a model for a Roman or Greek statue. And very frequently over the years, he had worked with the magnificent Natalia. Sometimes they had posed as husband and wife, sometimes as brother and sister, sometimes as father and daughter. He liked her best as she looked now, the black hair just past the shoulders, her own strikingly dark blue eyes rather than contacts, which had made them appear brown or green, her own slightly upturned nose, the figure that he had warmed himself beside so many nights. She was technically his second in command, his right hand, and though her heart was too soft sometimes, it had never interfered with her work. He stared into the darkness, trying to make out the shapes of the others of his team who were there, Nikolai, Yuri, Boris, Konstantin. He could not see them, and Karamazov smiled because of this. He checked the Rolex watch on his wrist and felt again in the darkness the safety catch on the 15-shot 9mm pistol he held, checked the position of the tiny blue Chief Special 38 at the small of his back, checked the 9mm MAC-10 slung from his shoulder. The ranch house was just outside the bracken, and as Karamazov and Natalia crossed the clearing, he could see the others of the team breaking from the shadows as well.
Damn.
Move forward! Move forward!
I'll go first. Cover me, Natalia. It is dark in there.
Karamazov stood in a crouch, his fists wrapped around the pistol butt, the first finger of his right hand poised against the revolver-like trigger of the auto-loading pistol.
Shall we restore the electricity, Vladimir?
Yes.
Lights! Hit the lights! Everyone on guard! Watch for survivors!
I don't think President Chambers is here, Vladimir.
No worry. We have all survived the night, at least. And as always, you are my right arm, Natalia.
I'm searching upstairs. Yuri, back me up.
Sure thing, little lady.
I do not like this Texan accent you've been training with lately. J. Check the rooms on the left, Yuri. I will clear the room to the right.
Natalia!
I'm fine. It's not Chambers. It appears to be a Mexican. Just one of the capitalist's millions of exploited workers.
Sarah?
Carla.
Sarah, that's Ron's rifle. And you got his pistol belt there, too.
Carla, I don't know how to tell you.
Ron's dead.
Yes.
I'm
sorry, Carla.
Mommy?
I'd like to be alone for a few minutes, Sarah. Can you take care of Millie for me?
Of course I will, Carla. Millie? Millie, come here. Let's give Mommy a couple of minutes, okay? Michael, Annie, you come too.
Miss Rourke, what's wrong with my mommy? Where's my daddy?
Millie, life has changed, but it's going to be okay.
What's happening, Miss Rourke?
Millie, your mommy will... Michael, watch the girls. I'll be right back.
Mom? What's happening, Mom?
Michael, no questions. Now.
Carla! Take care of Millie, Sarah. Please take care of my girl.
Yes. Of course I will. Oh, dear God.
I never ate something this bad in my life.
I'd eat that if I were you. Proteins, vitamins, sugar, all that stuff, including the moisture, is something your body's craving right now. Just reading a book burns up calories, so riding that bike all day, especially in this heat, really draws a lot out of your body.
Oh, God. This tastes like cardboard.
You eat much cardboard in your day, did you?
Well, no, but you know what I mean.
It doesn't taste good, but it's nutritious. Maybe we'll find something better than baby food tomorrow or the next day. When we get to the retreat, you can stuff yourself. I've got all the Mountain House freeze-dried foods, beef stroganoff, everything. I've got a lot of dehydrated vegetables, freezer full of meat, steaks, roasts, the works. I've even got good beer, pretzels, chocolate chip cookies, and booze. Everything.
Oh, man. I wish we were there.
Well, wishing won't get us anywhere.
What I wouldn't do for a candy bar.
Unless you're under high energy demand circumstances, candy isn't that good for you. Sugar is one of the worst things in the world.
Then why have you got chocolate chip cookies?
Well, you can't always eat stuff that's healthy for you.
What kind of chocolate chip cookies are they?
I don't remember. I always confuse the brands.
I found your one weakness. Bad at identifying chocolate chip cookies.
Well, nobody's perfect. Let's get a few hours of rest and get started before first light again. I'd like to put on as much desert mileage as we can during darkness. Want to make Van Horn and beyond tomorrow.
What's a Van Horn?
Maybe food and water and gasoline. Good-sized town, a little off the beaten track. Maybe it's in decent shape still. At least I hope so. Knew a guy from Van Horn once.
Think he's still there?
I don't know. Lost touch with him a few years ago. Might have died. No way to tell.
John, you are one strange guy. I've never met anybody so laid back in my whole life.
Yeah, that's exactly how I'm going to be in about 30 seconds. Laid back and sleeping. You better do the same.
Taking a leak?
No, I'm burying the jar from the baby food. There's no sense littering, and the sugar clinging to the sides of the glass will just draw insects.
World War III's wiped out a huge part of the world, and he doesn't want to be a litter bug.
Karamazov looked over at Natalia. She sat across from him, leaning back on one elbow on the long sofa where she had slept the remainder of the night after securing the house. The room was lit by the shallow light of the dawn, which was now breaking into day.
We must find Chambers. He would still be in Texas. This is his power base, and the militia units we have heard of and observed would be satisfactory troops around which he could organize armed resistance.
Perhaps he is only hiding.
I doubt it, Natalia. He must strike while the iron is warm.
Hot, Vladimir.
Yes, hot. He must, though. Once our forces are settled into position in strength, his task will be more difficult. Once we are able to organize a national identity system, collect all firearms, etc., his task will be virtually impossible. He must and will act now.
What are we going to do, boss?
We're going to split up, Yuri. That is what we are going to do. You and Natalia will take an aircraft into the western portion of the state. It is desert there. Travel by jeep back to Galveston. We will all rendezvous there at our command center near the coast. Equipment and fortifications should be finished within days there at any event. Radio communications will still be impossible, so unless a perfect opportunity presents itself to get Chambers, try nothing on your own, but instead run down as many leads as possible concerning his whereabouts and anticipated movements. Questions?
What about identities?
We don't have time to manufacture anything new. Simply use the papers you have with you to your best advantage. Unless you run into a skeptical organized force, there shouldn't be any difficulty. I wish I could offer more advice. Any other questions? Natalia, I wish to speak with you a moment. Yuri, go!
You got it, boss.
What is it, Vladimir?
Nothing, really. I just wish to tell you to be careful. That's all. These surviving Americans are crazy. All of them with guns, so ready to use them.
Was there anything else?
Yes. We can be together at the headquarters. I couldn't sleep last night. You know that?
Vladimir, I want this all to be over so that we can be together now that we have won.
This is the major step that we have dreamed of, Natalia. But America is not yet conquered. Our work is far from finished. But we can be together. More and more.
Natalia, the plane is waiting.
Yes, coming.
Sarah Rourke took a step back from the large grave. She had buried both Carla and Ron Jenkins there, then, with Michael's help, gathered rocks to cover the mound by the side of the road leading into the town. Two thick branches and one of Ron Jenkins's saddle thongs had made the cross, and with Jenkins's pocket knife she had tried to scratch names on it, but only the half-rotted bark had fallen away.
No need to make Millie and Annie cry again, Mom. We can pray for the Jenkins ourselves.
Maybe you're right. Let's just each of us be quiet a minute and say something to ourselves, okay?
Okay.
Are you all right, Michael?
I'm all right, Mom.
You really don't think Millie and Anne should come over and help us pray for the Jenkins?
No, Mom. I think they're happy playing.
Natalia pulled the straw cowboy hat down low over her eyes, squinting into the sun as she stood beside the jeep, waving to the departing cargo pilot. She turned her head as the dust became too intense and saw Yuri, his hair blowing in the wind the plane was generating. She climbed into the passenger seat and checked her pistol while she waited for Yuri. She had left the HK assault rifle behind as being out of character. Yuri was supposed to be her brother, and he was supposed to be a geologist. They had been out in the field, completely unaware of the terror sweeping the country. She turned the gun over in her hand. Like all the American and Western European origin conventional guns she and the rest of Karamazov's team used, they had been acquired technically illegally, according to American law. This was a particularly nice one, and she liked it, despite its limited capacity. A four-barreled stainless steel 357 Magnum COP pistol, Derringer-like, with a rotating firing pin and an overall size approximating a 380 automatic. It was pattern-loaded, the first round intended for snakes, a 38-357 shot shell, the last three chambers loaded with 125-grain jacketed hollow-point 357s. With the gun, she had a set of 22 long-rifle insert barrels, which even more greatly expanded its versatility. Leaning back in her seat, she pulled her hat lower over her eyes. The bandana, knotted around her throat, was already wet with perspiration, and her dark glasses did little to reduce the harsh glare of the sun.
Well, little lady, y'all ready to get on with this here safari?
Yuri, you are a fine agent. But if you do not stop talking like that to me, you will find cyanide in your tea, or a curare-tipped street pin inside your trouser leg. I don't like being called Little Lady. You are not to call me Captain Tiamarovna in the field. You are to call me Natalie, the American way of saying my first name. In fact, I should not be calling you Yuri. Why are you not correcting me? Your name for this operation is Grady Burns. I will call you that.
Sure thing, little... Natalie?
Better.
They drove through the sand dunes and in the general direction of Van Horn, where they hoped to find some information regarding Chambers. It was 1 o'clock, and the sun was beating down mercilessly from the peak of the sky.
Yuri! Grady, stop the jeep. I want to stretch my legs.
Do you want me to get, it out of the back of the jeep?
Whose idea was that chemical toilet?
Karamazov's idea. I think he was looking out for your comfort.
He needn't have bothered. Who are you?
Two men wearing t-shirts and faded jeans were standing on the top of the small dune, their faces leering. Automatically, she felt for her pistol as she started backing toward the jeep, remembering then that she had left it in the pocket of her jacket, still on the seat.
I said, who are you?
I heard what you said, girl.
Where is he? The man on the jeep, the man I was with.
Well, you don't have to worry yourself about him no more. He's dead. The slit his throat just as nice as you please, we did.
I don't believe you.
You see, he never noticed this here blade. Cause he was too busy looking at that.
The tall man gestured back toward the top of the dune. The second man swung his right hand from behind him now, a shotgun in it. The barrel's impossibly short, she thought. The stock of the shotgun all but gone. She noticed a leather strap from the butt of the shotgun stretched across the man's body like a sling. Natalia stared at the gang member closer to her, assessing his build, the way he stood, searching him with her eyes for additional weapons. There was a pistol crammed between the wide black belt he wore and the sagging beer pot under the sweat-stained t-shirt. As near as she could make out, the gun was a German Luger.
What do you want?
What do you think I want, girl?
The man took a step toward her. The knife was still in his right hand. As Natalia moved forward, both hands going toward him, her right hand flashed upwards, middle knuckles locked outwards towards the bottom of his nose. The blade dropped from his numb hand. Natalia snatched the Luger from the corpse's belt and wheeled towards the man with a sawed-off shotgun standing on top of the dune. Spinning for the first time to face the jeep, she spotted two men standing near it with looks of horror on their faces. Natalia hit the sand, bullets kicking it up into her face. The last man was working a bolt-action rifle, swinging the muzzle toward her. Natalia's shot took out the left eye. She automatically glanced down to the Luger's sights. The rear sight looked banged up, and she attributed the eyeball shot to that. She had aimed between the eyes. She rolled onto her back, the sun still almost directly overhead, momentarily blinding her. She realized that she had lost her sunglasses rolling through the sand. Her head hurt badly. Forcing herself to her feet, Natalia staggered toward the jeep. She burnt her fingers on the hot hood of the jeep, and the Luger slipped from her right hand. She was face to face with Yuri, his throat slit ear to ear in a clumsy fashion. He lay in the sand, his eyes wide open and staring into the sun.
He hit the radiator. Stupid!
As she began moving, the thought that drove Natalia was that the four men were probably not alone. The sketchy intelligence from the area indicated a large and heavily armed gang of looters and killers moving across the state.
Outriders! I gotta hurry!
The sun, to Rourke's left, was starting to sink rapidly because technically, despite the heat, it wasn't quite spring. Darkness would come soon, and Van Horn was still miles away. Water and food were virtually gone, and of more immediate concern, so was the gasoline. His bike was nearly empty, and he doubted Rubenstein's bike would make it another 20 or 30 miles.
What the... Is that...
Rubenstein, wait here in case this is a trap of some kind.
What do you mean, a trap?
Could be those paramilitary guys. Could be anyone. Put a woman's body down beside the road, most people are gonna stop, right? Plenty of cover back by those dunes, right?
Yeah, but... She's awful still.
Could be dead already. Or maybe she's never been alive. Just a bag of rags stuffed into some old clothes. Keep me covered.
Rourke swung the CAR-15 across the front of the Harley, throwing a glance back over his shoulder, seeing Rubenstein readying the German MP-40 subgun to back him up. Rourke cut a wide arc across the opposite shoulder, running a circle around the body. It was a woman, dark hair covering half her face, her right hand clutched to her left arm, dark bloodstains seeping through her fingers. Rourke kept the CAR-15 pointed in the woman's general direction, his right fist bunched around the pistol grip, his first finger just outside the trigger guard. He stared down at the woman's body inches from the dusty toes of his black combat boots, pushing the sunglasses back from his head and up into his hair. She was incredibly beautiful, even dirty and disheveled as she was now, and somewhere at the back of his mind, Rourke knew he'd seen the face before.
I wouldn't forget you.
He pushed the toe of his left boot toward her, moving her body a little and finally rolling her over. The limpness of her body spelled recent death or a deep state of unconsciousness. He swung the scoped CAR-15 behind his back, taking her head gently into his left hand, his right thumb slowly opening her left eyelid.
Find Sam Chambers. Get to the Jeep.
Her pulse was weak but steady. Her skin was waxy appearing and cold to the touch.
Shock. Heat prostration. Paul, do a wide circle to make sure she doesn't have any friends and come over. We've got to get her out of the sun.
Rourke scanned the horizon to see if there was any natural shade, fearing the woman might not survive until darkness. About 40 yards off to the left side of the road, he spotted an overhanging outcropping of bare rock. He quickly felt the woman's arms and legs and along the rib cage to ascertain that there were no readily apparent broken bones, then stood up, bringing the unconscious girl to her feet. Rourke carried the girl cradled in his arms like a child.
I'm heading over toward those rocks on the other side of the road. Bring your bike over there, then come back for mine. We gotta normalize her body temperature, so bring the water when you come back. She needs it more than we do.
Got it.
With the sun growing ever lower, there was ample shade under the outcropping of rock. Rourke looked down at the girl's face, then nodded to himself. It was a face he wouldn't forget, and he remembered it now, but still, he couldn't yet make the connection. The moon was bright, but there was a haze around it. Sarah Rourke recalls her husband using the phrase, blood on the moon. There was enough blood on the earth, she thought. All through the day, she had followed along the path of the brigands who had tortured Ron Jenkins, and everywhere they had gone, small farms, two more towns, the scene had been the same. Wanton destruction, dead people and animals everywhere. But their trail had taken a sharp turn back into the northeastern portion of the state, and now, as she guessed she was crossing the border into Tennessee, as best she could judge, they were behind her and going in an entirely different direction, each mile taking them farther away. Sarah looked behind her. Michael was riding her husband's horse Sam by himself now, and Millie and her own daughter Annie were riding Carla Jenkins's mount, and Ron Jenkins's Appaloosa was carrying most of the cargo. It was a better arrangement for the animals, and every few hours she swapped horses with Michael to rest Tildy from her weight. They had several more days ahead before they'd reach Mount Eagle, Tennessee. Once they got there, Sarah would try searching for Millie's aunt, who had a small farm there. Earlier in the day, Sarah had tried questioning Millie about where the farm was, but the girl had remained silent, just as she had been since the death of her parents the previous night. At the back of her mind, Sarah Rourke realized that if the girl did not respond, trying to find her surviving family would be hopeless. And by leaving Georgia, Sarah thought bitterly, she was cutting down on her chances of reuniting with her husband. She had concretized the idea in her mind that John Thomas Rourke was still alive, out there somewhere, and looking for her even now. She realized that if she once abandoned that idea, she would be without hope. She could not see any value in a life of constantly running from outlaws, living in the wild like hunted animals. She bent low over the saddle horn. The pains in her stomach were increasing in frequency and severity. It wasn't the time of the month for her period, though she supposed it possible she was having it early. But the cramps were somehow different anyway. She had tried the water near the one town they had passed, she recalled. Something had been odd tasting, and she had kept the children and the horses away from it and gone on. Hours later, she had found bottled water in an abandoned convenience store and stocked up.
Mama!
Don't worry, Michael.
Mom, are you okay?
Just...
Find Sam Chambers.
Rubenstein sat in the darkness, watching the rising and falling of the strange girl's chest in the moonlight, the Schmeisser cradled in his lap. His mouth was dry. He'd given up cigarette smoking 2 years earlier, but now having a cigarette was all he could think about. He looked at the Timex on his wrist. Rourke had been gone for more than an hour, out searching for the Jeep the woman had been mumbling about. If there was one out there, it most likely meant at least some food, water, and gasoline. It sounded like a long shot to Rubenstein. After all, why would the woman have left the Jeep in the first place if she had all of those necessities? But he wasn't the survival expert. Rourke had mounted up and gone, leaving the Steyr Mannlicher SSG rifle with Rubenstein for added protection. The light-gathering qualities of the 3.9 variable Mannlicher scope that rode it was something Rourke had labeled potentially useful if whoever had wounded the girl were still out there somewhere in the darkness. The thought of more violence-prone thieves didn't appeal to Rubenstein. He shivered in the darkness. The girl's body temperature was about normal, Rourke had said, and she wasn't really so much unconscious anymore as just sleeping. Rourke had cleansed and bandaged the deep flesh wound on her left forearm. Her right hand still had blood on it, but only from the arm wound, which Rourke had not washed away because of the water shortage.
I know you're out there. I hear you. I've got a submachine gun, so don't try anything.
That doesn't do much to scare a rattler, Paul.
Rubenstein turned, seeing Rourke standing beside the sleeping woman, the CAR-15 in his hands, the sling suspending the gun beneath his right shoulder. What?
A rattler. Your body heat's drawing him. Move over.
Ah! What are you doing, Rourke?
I'm sighting with the iron. This kind of scope wouldn't be much good at this range.
Bang! Bang?
Yeah. I'm not shooting a snake unless he comes into camp and we have to. The last thing I'm going to do is advertise to everybody and his brother we're here, we got guns, and we're stupid enough to go shooting at something in the dark. Keep an eye out for that snake and I'll bring my bike up.
Why did you leave it?
What if something had happened? Somebody'd wandered into camp and gotten the drop on you.
That wouldn't have happened.
Happened to her. After I found her Jeep, I backtracked it. I didn't figure I'd have to go far. It was a bullet hole in the radiator, and in today's heat, the thing couldn't have gone far without the engine stalling out. It was a dead man, either her boyfriend or her husband, and they just didn't believe in rings. Throat slit ear to ear. Four other dead men there, bikers, well-armed. Looks like our lady friend there shot all four.
Maybe there's more of them out there.
Actually, I'd say there's probably a lot of them out there. Anyway, this young lady is a pro. I found a jacket that looked like it was small enough to be hers. Had an interesting little gun in it. The dead man with his throat slit was carrying a Walther P-38K. Pretty serious piece of hardware. The muzzle was threaded on the inside for a silencer. I found the silencer back at the Jeep, stuffed inside one of the tubular supports for the seat frame.
Jesus!
I doubt that was his name.
Mom. Mama, wake up. It's morning.
Michael Rourke looked across the flat expanse of ground and confirmed the rising sun. Millie and Annie were still asleep. The horses were still tied to the tree that he'd secured the reins to the previous night. Their saddles were still in position. After his mother had fallen down and he hadn't been able to awaken her, he'd had Millie and Annie watch her, and he had loosened the straps under the horses' bellies that held the saddles on. His mother called them cinches.
Millie! Annie! Get up! Time to get up!
How is Mommy?
She'll be okay, Annie. Wake up Millie and have her make something to eat. You know where the food is. Millie can reach the bags.
Millie! Millie, get up! Michael says to make something to eat.
Mom?
Oh.
Annie, get Mama some water. Mom, are you gonna be okay?
Shh. I'll be all right, honey. Just give me a hug and don't ask me to get up for a while, okay?
Rourke leaned back against the rock face, staring out across the desert as the sun, orange against the gray sky, winked up over the horizon to the east. He hunched his shoulders in his leather jacket, both hands wrapped around a white-flecked black metal mug of steaming coffee.
Now, this is more like it. Life on a trail, I mean. Food, coffee, water.
Simple things can mean a lot. Give yourself a few minutes.
What's that I smell?
Coffee. You want some? Yours, anyway.
Who are you?
My name's John Rourke. He's Paul Rubenstein.
What the hell are you doing drinking my coffee?
Well, you're a pleasant one, aren't you? You probably don't remember. You were dying, then we saved your life. I went back and found your Jeep, buried your boyfriend or husband a few miles back beyond that, hauled up the gasoline, the water, the food, some of your stuff. Then to make sure your fever didn't start back up, we slept in shifts the rest of the night watching you. I figure that earns me a cup of coffee, some gas, and some food and water. You got any objections?
You got any cigarettes to go with the coffee?
Here. I guess these are yours. I found them at the Jeep.
What happened to my arm?
Well, looks like you got shot.
Anybody got a light? You look familiar. I think I know you from somewhere. I mean, that should be your line, but I really do. That bandage is very professional.
John's a doctor, among other things.
I had the same feeling when I first saw you by the road, that I know you from somewhere.
What happened?
I was hoping you could tell me. Paul and I just spotted your body by the side of the road, saw you were hurt, and tried to help.
Did I talk? How did you know where to find the Jeep?
You didn't say much. You were mumbling something about a Jeep and Sam Chambers. If I remember, before the war, he was still down here in Texas, just been appointed Secretary of Communications to the President.
The war?
Don't you know about the war?
What war?
Well, it looks like we got some catching up to do.
God, it's so green here. This entire property is grand.
East Texas by the Louisiana border here is green like this most of the time. But I think it's time for the meeting to start now, President Chambers.
Don't call me that yet, George. I'm Secretary of Communications, and that's it.
But you're the only surviving man in the line of succession, sir. You are the president.
I was up in Tyler last year in October for the Rose Festival. This just might be the prettiest part of the state of Texas. Here, north of here, and down south to the Gulf.
Sir, they're waiting?
I'm coming, George. I just couldn't see a garden like this without stopping to smell the flowers.
Chambers stood up and reached into his shirt pocket, snatching a cigarette. He turned and began walking toward the double French doors that led back from the walled yard to the library inside the nearly century-old stone house.
I wonder how I'll get these now with the war.
I'm sure we can find enough to last a long time for you, sir.
I'm about to make history, George. When I walk into that room, I can either reject the call to the presidency or I can accept it. And if I accept it, what will I be president of? It's a wasteland out there beyond this garden. At least, much of it is, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
Pretty much the whole West Coast is gone. New York was blown off the map. What am I going to be offered the presidency of? A sore that isn't smart enough to know that it can't heal.
I don't know, sir.
Well, time will tell, won't it, George?
I suppose it will, Secretary Chambers.
Well then, shall we?
Rourke stared up the road at the stricken faces of the men, women, and children struggling slowly toward them. He watched the women hug the children closer to them, some of the men starting to raise sticks or axes as if for defense. Who are they, John?
They're refugees from some town up ahead. It's written all over their faces, Paul.
I do know you from somewhere. I know you from your voice.
And I know you. I wonder what'll happen when we remember from where, John.
I don't know. Paul, dismount and give your SMG to Natalie. Go tell them we don't mean them any harm.
But how do I know they don't mean me any harm?
I'll cover you.
All right.
Don't tell me you can't figure out how to use that gun. Remember, I saw the job you did back there at the Jeep.
Whatever do you mean?
Sure, lady.
Rourke watched as Rubenstein, hands outspread as though he were approaching an unfamiliar dog, walked toward the refugees.
Hey, look! We're good guys! Don't mean you any harm. Maybe we can help you.
Paul, look out!
A man started toward Rubenstein with a long-handled scythe. Rourke's hand shot towards his python and the Ranger cami holster on his pistol belt. Rubenstein spun on his heel, the Browning high power in his right hand, his left hand pushing his glasses back off the bridge of his nose.
His assailant was frozen like a statue, staring at the remaining half of his scythe.
Like I said, sure, lady.
Natalie slid from the back of his Harley and handed him the Schmeisser. The bolt still open, the safety on. She walked a few steps ahead of the bike, stopped and wiped the palms of her hands against her blue jean thighs, shot a glance over her shoulder at Rourke, then started walking slowly toward the people, the refugees, the closest now less than a dozen feet from Paul Rubenstein.
Listen to us, please. We don't want to hurt any of you at all. I fired to protect my friend here. We want to help.
Natalie walked towards the crowd, reaching out her right hand slowly and tousling the sandy hair of a boy of about 10, who stood pressed against a woman Rourke assumed to be the boy's mother. Rourke looked down to the MP40, pulled the magazine and let the bolt kick forward, then reseated the magazine.
Where are you people from? What happened to you all?
She's telling you the truth. We just want to know where you all are from and what happened. I'm a doctor. Maybe I can help some of you.
Help me! Help me, please! My baby's sick!
The faces on both sides of the desperate woman melted away as Rourke moved closer to her. She was on her knees, crying, holding a baby in her arms, the blanket stained dark red with blood.
I'm sorry, ma'am. This child is dead.
No!
Rourke, Rubenstein, and Natalie spent several hours with the refugees. The people were from a town some 15 miles or so up ahead, a place Rourke had never heard of. There had been a cafe and a U.S. Border Patrol station there.
Oh,
a gang had
sleeping.
Come through.
He was tossing and turning so much that it woke me up and I couldn't get back to sleep. I kept wondering if the radiation from the bombs was going to get to us and kill my baby. Then I remember hearing all this commotion. Engine noises, gunshots, screaming and all. I thought maybe something good was happening. Like maybe there was U.S. troops coming in or them Border Patrol men had come back. I got up and looked out the window and saw them. There was maybe a couple hundred of them. All of them kind of young. Some of them riding motorcycles. Some of them in pickup trucks or jeeps. Some of our folks started running out into the streets. Some of the men shooting at the strangers. But they all got shot down or run over. They started smashing and burning everything up. Stealing everything like they owned the whole world or something. Jim was up then. And he took his rifle and ran out after them. And
They took those of us they didn't kill and lined us up in the street. Just gunned down some of us for fun, it looked like. Raped some of the women there in the street, making us all watch. Took some of the women with them. Looted all the houses and the couple stores we had. Took every gun in town and all the food and water they could find. And told us to go before they changed their minds about wasting the bullets and just killed us all.
They must be up ahead of us somewhere, Paul.
I hope we get to meet them.
Chances are we will. Anybody see who shot that other woman's baby? What he looked like?
I saw him. Not too tall. Thin kind of and had blonde hair. Curly and pretty like a girl, maybe. And his little beard on the end of his chin. Carried a long, fancy-looking pistol. That's what he used to kill her baby. That's what he killed that little girl with!
Listen, ma'am. I can't promise you we'll find that man. But I can promise you that if we do, I'll kill him for you.
You must assume the presidency, sir. With all due respect, it is your constitutional obligation.
Everyone!
Colonel Darlington, you and everyone here urge me to essentially crown myself as President of the United States, when I'm not even sure there still is a United States. According to Captain Reed's contact through Army channels before the Army ceased to function as a unified command, Soviet landings were anticipated in Chicago and several other major U.S. cities that were neutron bombed. We could and probably do have thousands of Soviet troops already in the country and thousands more on the way. The worse the damage our forces did to them, the more desperate they'll be to utilize our surviving factories and natural resources to get their own country back on its feet. And what about the radiation fallout? The famine, the economic collapse we're facing now. Is there actually a country, even a world, that's going to be able to go on, even if it wants to? Answer me that, Colonel.
I've been listening to this, sir, and I've reached one conclusion, and I think it should be obvious to everyone here by now. We're talking about a situation of mass confusion out there. The former president did what he had to do, Had he stayed alive, essentially trapped in his retreat, the Soviets could have used him for whatever they wanted to, with or without his cooperation. But you're different, sir. Your sentiments against communism on a philosophical basis are widely known, so putting words in your mouth would be useless. They don't have you trapped in one spot. They don't know where you are. Now we can see that apparently there are people still alive. There are armed citizens out there willing to fight someone. But someone has to point them in the right direction, to channel what they're doing. Maybe that's the word. We need someone to channel the energies of the country. We need a leader, and we don't have that now. And there's no one else but you, sir.
Captain Reed is right, sir. He put it better than any of us, Mr. President.
Chambers looked around the room, spotting Colonel Darlington, Captain Reed, and others in the room. Randon Soames, commander of the Texas Militia Volunteer Paramilitary Group, Federal Judge Arthur Bennington, his own aide George Cripp, and others.
Well, I suppose there is no choice. Judge Bennington, bring up the Bible. I suppose even in a time like this, an oath will count for something.
The four-parting company with the refugee party early the next morning, Rourke sent Rubenstein back down the road in the direction in which the refugee party would be traveling, to scout 20 miles ahead, then come back. The younger man, dark hair whipping across his high forehead, eyes squinted both against the sun and apparently to keep the perpetually slipping wire-rimmed glasses from falling off the bridge of his nose, returned almost exactly 40 minutes later, reporting nothing up ahead for the refugees and nothing close behind for Rourke. Rourke, with the girl he knew as Natalie sitting behind him on his bike, watched as the refugee group straggled out of sight down the road, then turned to Rubenstein, straddling the Harley beside him. Rourke glanced at the smaller man, noting that the complexion, which had been pallid only days earlier and then red from the sun, was now starting to darken. Already, too, there was an added leanness about Rubenstein's face.
Well, partner, you about ready?
As ready as I'll ever be.
Natalie, hold on tight. I want to make some time. We got 75 miles to Van Horn. If we're lucky, we can make it there in about an hour.
Hopefully, we won't hit any traffic.
They rode hard, flanking the yellow line at the center of the road. Rourke checked his speedometer, his odometer, and then the Rolex wristwatch, then bored his eyes back up the road. It took them less than an hour to reach the low, bridged highway running past smokeless high chimneys. Beyond them were the faint outlines of buildings, scorching under the already intense sun. Rourke glanced at his watch. The Rolex read nearly 10 a.m. now.
Van Horn.
It looks dead.
It probably is for the most part.
What do we do now?
Well, we need food and water, and Rubenstein here could use some clip-on sunglasses before the glare does permanent damage to his eyes. You could probably stand some things. And we could use some more gasoline. I promised I'd get you as far as I could toward Galveston. I don't know yet whether Paul and I are going to have to go down that far to find a safe way of getting onto the other side of the Mississippi. From what I was able to judge from the air that night, the night of the war, it looked as though that entire area should be nothing but a nuclear wasteland. But there's no way of telling that from here, unless you know something we don't.
Remember, I hadn't even heard about the war until you and Paul told me.
Yeah, I remember that. I guess, though, it sort of strikes me as odd that you seem so good with a gun, seem to have seen refugees close up before, and that somewhere in the back of each of our minds, we remember each other from somewhere. I just thought maybe some vibrations or something might have come to you about the Mississippi Delta region.
Sorry.
Sorry. Well, since you seem to just have this mystical skill with borrowed handguns and submachine guns, when we get down there into Van Horn, until we rearm you with something more than that little pea shooter you got, why don't you just snatch my python out of the leather here in case some shooting starts? I think if you study it for a while, you can figure out how it works, right?
I'd imagine I can.
Good. Paul, there's one main drag down there, probably. When we hit the town, I'll wait 5 minutes. You cut down along the perimeter as fast as you can, then turn into the main street and start back towards me. Those bastards who destroyed that town those refugees came from are up ahead of us somewhere. I figure they probably already attacked Van Horn, but some of them could have hung around. People like that are usually pretty loosely organized, coming and going when they please. Keep that thing you call a Schmeisser ready, huh?
Gotcha.
Natalie, that python of mine is magnaported, gas venting slots on each side of the barrel, so it won't give you as much felt recoil as you might expect.
I don't understand.
Then fake it.